Graphic Audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents J.A. Johnstone's The Loner, narrated by Ken Jackson, with performances by Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Casey Platt, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, Kimberly Gilbert, Thomas Keegan, Stephen Carpenter, Tim Carlin, Tracy Oliveira, Gregory Gorton, Terrence Aselford, Yasmin Twazon, Tim Getman, Alyssa Willman, Tim Pabone, David Coyne, Mort Shelby, Joe Brack, Danny Gavigan, Bradley Smith, Evan Casey, Richard Rowan, Scott McCormick, and Daniel Sontag. The Loner, Book 11, Crossfire. All roads lead home. Conrad Browning had heard someone say that once. He didn't understand it, and he definitely didn't agree with it. Maybe it was true for some people, but not for him. In order for it to be true, he would have to have a home, and he didn't, not anymore. Looking at Carson City, Nevada, he felt nothing. Although he had lived here, it was just the place where his wife had been kidnapped, a crime that had culminated in her brutal murder. He had been raised in Boston, but that wasn't home either, as he had discovered on his most recent visit. It was the place where he had met Pamela Tarleton and become engaged to her, the single worst mistake of his life, the mistake that ultimately had brought him nothing but tragedy and grief. Standing on the steps of the hospital in Carson City, Conrad gave a little shake of his head to break himself out of that grim reverie. He went inside, took off his hat, and went to the desk in the hospital lobby, where a white-uniformed nurse greeted him with a smile. Conrad knew a lot of the nurses were smitten with him, but that didn't mean much to him.
Good morning, Mr. Browning. You here to see your friend?
That's right. How's he doing?
Mr. Vincenzo is doing very well. Dr. Taggart says he's getting stronger all the time. You can go on up to his room if you like.
Thanks.
Arturo's room was on the second floor. Conrad went up the wide, curving staircase, still holding his hat. Nurses and doctors passed him in the corridor. He was a familiar sight. He had spent practically every visiting hour available at the hospital since he'd brought in his friend. Conrad pushed open the door of the private room. It was a bright, cheery place, at least for a hospital. Morning sunlight spilled brilliantly through a window with the curtains pushed back. It was the finest room available, as Conrad had ordered. Arturo Vincenzo was sitting up in bed with pillows propped behind him, reading a novel by William Dean Howells. When he was healthy, he was a tall, slender, vaguely bird-like man with thinning brown hair. In the hospital, he was paler than usual, not having seen the sun for a while, and the ordeal he had gone through had etched some additional lines in his face and given him a certain gaunt aspect. Arturo had suffered a bullet wound in the chest, a bullet intended for Conrad, and had come very close to dying. The local medico in Cavendish, Nevada, the small settlement where the shooting had taken place, wasn't much good as a doctor, but somehow he had kept Arturo from bleeding to death and had stabilized his condition enough so Conrad was able to get him on the train and take him to Carson City. Once the train arrived, an ambulance wagon had carried Arturo from the depot to the hospital, and the doctor who had taken over the case had operated almost immediately to repair the damage caused to Arturo's right lung where the bullet nicked it. The slug had broken a rib, too. Now it was just a matter of rest and recuperation, and Conrad thought Arturo looked a little better, a little stronger, every day. For a man who had never appeared to be much of a physical specimen, Arturo had proven to be surprisingly hardy and resilient. He marked his place in the book and set it aside.
Good morning, sir.
I think you can stop calling me sir.
I am still in your employ, am I not?
Of course you are. You've got a job for as long as you want it, either with me or Claudius Turnbuckle. Claudius made that clear in the wire.
Turnbuckle was a partner in the San Francisco law firm of Turnbuckle & Stafford. He and John J. Stafford were also good friends to Conrad, and had been handling many of his business affairs for years, ever since Conrad had inherited half of the lucrative Browning financial holdings from his late mother, Vivian. The other half of Vivian's estate had gone to Conrad's father, the notorious gunfighter Frank Morgan, better known as the Drifter. Like Conrad, Frank didn't take any active interest in the business. He had never paid much attention to it. Frank was content to wander, as he had been doing for decades before he inherited a fortune, and most of the time, Conrad had no idea where his father was. As soon as Arturo was out of immediate danger and recovering from surgery, Conrad had gotten in touch with Turnbuckle and made arrangements to have all the medical expenses taken care of. He had also advised Turnbuckle that he would be arriving in San Francisco sometime in the relatively near future. Turnbuckle knew the details of the quest that had taken Conrad across the country from Boston, and Conrad knew he could count on the lawyer for help. When Conrad broke his engagement to Pamela Tarleton in order to marry beautiful blonde Rebel Callahan, Pamela had been pregnant, something Conrad hadn't known at the time. She had returned to Boston and given birth to twins, a boy and a girl, naming them Frank and Vivian after Conrad's parents. Then she had hidden them away before embarking on a campaign of vengeance against Conrad, whom she blamed not only for breaking their engagement, but also for the death of her railroad baron father, a criminal who had actually been murdered by his own partner in corruption. Pamela didn't see it that way, and her lust for revenge had resulted in Rebel's death and in numerous attempts on Conrad's life, even after Pamela herself had been killed accidentally while trying to carry out one of her schemes. One of her cruelest blows had come from beyond the grave, in a letter she'd written that was delivered to Conrad by one of her relatives. In that missive, calculated to tear his heart out, she had informed him that he was a father and practically dared him to find his hidden children. Since then, with the help of Arturo, a valet and all-around assistant who had come to be a good friend, Conrad had been on a cross-country search for the twins. He knew Pamela had taken the children and set out from Boston for San Francisco. Fearing she might have stashed them somewhere, he had taken his time and asked questions about them at every settlement along the road. Because of that, he knew the twins had still been with Pamela when she reached Nevada. It wasn't far to San Francisco, and every instinct in his body told him that she had taken them with her all the way to the coast. He had decided to bypass the rest of the smaller settlements and head directly for the city by the bay. Although it was a gamble, his instincts told him it might pay off.
You're brooding about Miss Tarleton and the children again, aren't you, sir?
Sorry. I should be more worried about you right now.
Ah, nonsense. I'm feeling much better, and Dr. Taggart says my condition is improving on a daily basis. In fact, he told me there's no reason for you to remain here for the duration of my recuperative period. You can proceed to San Francisco anytime you wish.
Are you sure Dr. Taggart said that, or is that you talking?
It is true that I don't wish to delay you. And Lord knows, the evidence indicates you have a difficult time taking care of yourself without me around. But you can ask the doctor for yourself if you'd like. He and the nurses are perfectly capable of looking after me, and since all the financial arrangements have been already made with Mr. Turnbuckle, there's really no reason for you to stay, is there?
I suppose there's not, other than the fact that I'll miss you.
Well, I'll be well enough to travel in another week or 10 days, according to the doctor. At that time, I'll come straight away to San Francisco and contact Mr. Turnbuckle. You'll keep him apprised of your current activities and whereabouts.
I'm sure I will.
Well, there you go. Goodbye. Have a good trip to Frisco.
I've heard the people who live there don't like that name.
Perhaps not. But we don't live there, do we?
Conrad put his hat on.
All right. I won't argue with you. I'll head for the train station right now and see when the next westbound is due.
He put out his hand.
Thanks for everything, Arturo. I'm sorry you may miss out on the end of this.
As long as your quest is successful, sir, that is all I care about.
Arturo shook Conrad's hand.
I'm going to find the doctor and talk to him before I go, just to make sure he thinks it's all right.
I would expect nothing less from you, sir.
Dr. Liam Taggart, a middle-aged man with the sad face of a hound, nodded and agreed with Arturo's suggestion when Conrad talked to him a few minutes later.
Mr. Vincenzo's recovery is coming along splendidly. We'll take good care of him. You can go on about your business without worrying, Mr. Browning.
I'm glad to hear that. If you need anything, Doctor, don't hesitate to wire my attorneys in San Francisco. They'll handle everything.
Of course.
Conrad left the hospital. It was a beautiful day. The air was crystal clear, and the mountains near Carson City seemed close enough to reach out and touch. As he gazed at the splendor around him, he avoided a certain area. He didn't want to look at or think about Black Rock Canyon, the place where Rebel had died. Unfortunately, once those dark thoughts entered his head, it was almost impossible to banish them. Conrad's hand stabbed toward the Colt on his hip as he whirled. His keen eyes instantly spotted two men with guns about 20 feet from him. They stood next to a parked wagon, evidently intending to use it for cover if they needed to. Smoke curled from the revolver held by one man, and the other would-be assassin was lining up his shot. Conrad crouched and fired. The bullet slammed into the gunman's left shoulder and knocked him to the pavement. The first man fired again, but he was on the move. His shot went wild and missed Conrad by several feet. As the gunman darted around the horses hitched to the wagon, Conrad held his fire. He didn't want to hit any of the animals. The man he had wounded was groping for the gun he'd dropped a few seconds earlier. Conrad quickly ran to the gun and kicked it out of reach. The wounded man slumped on the pavement again as he appeared to pass out from the shock of his injury. Conrad knew the man he had shot ought to survive. It was unlikely he would bleed to death since he was practically on the front steps of the hospital. Wanting at least one of the bushwhackers alive to question, Conrad ran after the one who had disappeared into the mouth of the alley across the street, between a saloon and a hardware store. He pressed his back to the front wall of the saloon next to the alley and listened. He didn't hear running footsteps, but was pretty sure the man was waiting for him. As soon as he showed himself, he'd be silhouetted in the mouth of the alley and the gunman would open fire. Instead of waltzing right into that trap, Conrad slapped aside the bat wings and hurried into the saloon. People gawked at him and got out of his way as he headed toward the stairs at the back of the room. A bartender with a bung starter gripped firmly in his hand moved to block Conrad's path.
Hey, mister, what do you think you're...
He stopped short and stepped back from the cold-eyed glance Conrad gave him. Taking the steps three at a time, Conrad got to the second floor landing in a hurry. Turning to the right, beside the alley where the bushwhacker was hidden, he jerked open the closest door and found the shabby bedroom inside empty. He went to the open window and peered out cautiously. He saw what he wanted to see. About a dozen feet from the street, the gunman crouched behind a rain barrel, watching the mouth of the alley. His gun was leveled over the top of the barrel, and all his attention was focused in that direction as he waited for Conrad to appear. It would have been easy for Conrad to gun him down from the window, but when you shot somebody, there was always a risk you would kill them. He didn't want that. He wanted the man to talk and reveal who had hired him to murder Conrad Browning. The window in the next room was almost directly above the place where the gunman was hidden. Conrad hurried there and opened the door. Seeing it empty, he moved toward the open window and looked out. The bushwhacker was still below in the alley, crouched behind the barrel. Judging the distance from the window to the ground, Conrad decided the drop wouldn't be too bad. He slid his Colt back in its holster and lifted a leg over the windowsill. Conrad saw that the gunman still hadn't noticed him and jumped. Conrad crashed on top of the man and drove him to the ground. Conrad clamped his left hand on the man's right wrist and shoved the gun aside as a shot blasted from it. Conrad quickly grabbed the man by his hair and slammed his face into the ground twice.
By God, stop attacking that fellow or I shoot!
Conrad looked up at the lawman, who had his shotgun pointed at the two men in the alley.
Be careful with that greener, Marshal. If it goes off, you'll kill both of us down here.
Stand up and move away from that man, you damn loco weed! You're under arrest for attempted murder, assault and battery, unlawfully discharging a firearm, trespassing, and anything else I can think of.
Conrad gestured toward the semi-conscious man at his feet.
Blast it, he's the one who tried to kill me. Him and his partner I wounded out on the street.
So you're the one who shot that hombre. I might have noted. Take your gun out and drop it.
Not hardly. It's nearly brand new. I'm not going to drop it in the mud.
Stay right there. Don't you move, you hear me?
I'm not going anywhere.
Not until he found out for sure who had tried to have him killed. Suddenly, three more men wearing badges and carrying shotguns walked into the alley. The first lawman waved his greener.
Settle down, Hargitay. This is Conrad Browning. We're not going to arrest him.
Who?
He used to live here. In fact, he was one of Carson City's leading citizens. Owns railroads, mines, banks, ships, you name it. Friend of the governor.
That don't matter, Wallace. He shot a man on the street, raised hell in that saloon, and assaulted this fella. I say he's under arrest.
If you'd bother to question any witnesses, you'd know this man and the one Mr. Browning shot tried to kill him right in front of the hospital. That's the first thing Stevens and I determined when we got here. Mr. Browning fired his gun in self-defense. and he was trying to apprehend the second gunman. Looks like he succeeded.
But no offense,
I'm Chief Deputy. You and Stevens take this man and lock him up.
I'm going to want to ask him some questions later.
That's fine, as long as Marshal Owens goes along with it. Right now, I want to see how that man you wounded is doing. Are you coming along?
Yes, I am. He may be able to tell me what I want to know.
Who paid the two of them to ambush you?
That's right. I've got a pretty good idea, but I'd like for it to be confirmed.
The slender, solemn-faced Wallace motioned for Conrad to follow him and left the alley, heading across the street to the hospital. The lobby was in an uproar, not surprising since there had been a gun battle right outside. Dr. Liam Taggart was talking to several men, some in white coats, the rest in business suits. Taggart spotted Conrad approaching with Deputy Wallace and came across the lobby to greet them.
Are you all right, Mr. Browning? The rumor is that you were the target of an assassination attempt.
That's true, but I'm fine. Nothing hurt but my dignity and my wardrobe.
I'll have a nurse tell Mr. Vincenzo right away that you're all right. He was quite worried when he heard the shots. He seemed to think it was a foregone conclusion you were involved in the trouble, whatever it was.
Arturo knows me pretty well.
Taggart crooked a finger at a nurse and gave her the message to deliver to Arturo.
What about the wounded man? I assume he was brought in here?
Yes, he's in surgery at the moment to repair his shoulder. You shot him?
Seemed like the thing to do at the time.
Your bullet did an extensive amount of damage. I doubt he'll ever be able to use his left arm properly again.
Well, maybe he won't try to bushwhack anybody else. We're going to want to talk to him.
Well, you'll have to wait a good long time. It'll take a while for the ether to wear off.
We have another prisoner we can question, I suppose. In the meantime, I'm going to assign a deputy to guard this one. There'll be somebody outside the man's room all the time until he's healthy enough for us to take him to jail.
Well, that's fine, deputy. As long as it doesn't interfere with anything of a medical nature we have to do.
There's something else, doctor. During the shooting, I heard someone cry out when one of the shots missed me. Was somebody hit by a stray bullet?
As a matter of fact, that's right. A young woman was struck.
Was she badly hurt?
Well, scared out of her wits more than anything else. The bullet barely nicked her hip before smashing into a lamppost. She'll be sore and limp for a week or so, but she'll be fine. We have her in a ward right now, mostly because she's bordering on hysteria. She's so upset about being shot.
Send all her bills to Claudius Turnbuckle. He'll see to it they're taken care of.
That's pretty generous of you, considering the young lady's injury was an accident.
The only accident was that she got hit instead of me. I'm getting mighty tired of things like that happening.
The prisoner was a lantern-jawed man with a drooping black mustache. His gray tweed suit was covered with drying mud stains. Conrad hadn't noticed those details during the brief shootout and the fight that followed. He had been too busy trying to stay alive. Chief Deputy Wallace and Conrad stood outside the prisoner's cell.
His name's Ed Gillespie. We didn't have any trouble identifying him. He's a cheap hold-up artist and gunman. Been in and out of jail for years. But we've never been able to convict him of murder and send him to the gallows, even though we're pretty sure he's killed several people. The man you shot is probably Walt Farley. He and Gillespie have been mixed up in plenty of shady deals together.
Gillespie sat on the bunk inside the cell, not saying anything. He kept his eyes turned toward the floor and didn't acknowledge that Conrad and Wallace were there. Wallace grasped one of the bars in the cell door.
Gillespie, you can make it easier on yourself if you'll answer a few questions.
Gillespie didn't look up. It was like he hadn't heard Wallace and didn't know the deputy was there.
Come on. You're going to prison no matter what you do, but you know we can make it a lot rougher on you if we want to. You and Farley didn't go after Mr. Browning and try to kill him in broad daylight on some whim. You'd only do a thing like that if you were being paid to. I want to know who you're working for.
Gillespie continued staring at the floor.
Sorry.
Wallace turned to Conrad.
We can work him over until he talks, but it may take a while.
Conrad looked along the section of cell block in the city jail. The other cells were empty.
Or you can step outside for a few minutes and let me talk to him.
He rested his hand on the butt of the Colt at his hip.
Now, wait a minute.
Wallace held up his hands.
You can't just...
Why not? You said yourself he's a killer who's gotten away with murdering people in the past. Anything that happened to him now would be a fitting punishment, don't you think?
For the first time, Gillespie's eyes flicked up, then back down. He had heard what Conrad said and knew what he meant.
Marshal Owens would never forgive me if he found out I let you get out of prisoner. It'd mean my job, Mr. Browning. I'm sorry.
What do you make in a year, deputy?
Wallace frowned and named a figure.
I can pay you twice that. Never even know the money is gone. You can probably find another job in 2 years' time, don't you think?
Wallace rubbed his jaw and appeared to be pondering the idea.
Well, sure I could. If things got too loud back here, though, I might have to spread around a little more cash to keep it quiet.
Whatever it costs, the money doesn't matter.
Wait a minute. Deputy, you can't let this...
You hear something, Mr. Browning? It's funny. I was talking a minute ago and nobody seemed to hear me. Now I'm not sure I can hear anything.
Gillespie came up off the bunk and grasped the bars.
Oh, wait, damn it! I'll tell you what you want to know. Just don't let this loco varmint anywhere near me.
Wallace leaned his head to the side, indicating Conrad should back away from the bars. Conrad cooperated as Wallace glared through the bars.
Who paid you to kill Mr. Browning here?
First, you gotta tell me. Is Walt all right?
Oh, you're concerned about your friend. How touching. Yeah, he's in the hospital. They fixed his busted shoulder. He'll be laid up for a while, and then he'll be in prison. Maybe the judge will put the two of you in the same cell. That sound good to you?
Shut your nasty mouth. Walt's a good hombre. Always been square with me, that's all. As for who paid us to go after this fella, you go talk to Carl Monroe. That's all I gotta say.
I reckon that'll do for now.
You wouldn't have really turned that lunatic loose on me, would you, Deputy?
I wouldn't count on it.
Wallace and Conrad walked out of the cell block and into the jail's lobby.
Who's Carl Monroe?
Lawyer. Crooked lawyer. I wasn't surprised to hear Gillespie mention his name. Gillespie and Farley have been tied in with Monroe before. Don't you remember Monroe from when you lived here before? His name turned up in the paper quite a bit. Anytime there was some big swindle or scandal.
I was busy with other things.
We'll haul Monroe in and talk to him. But I don't know how much we can get out of him. He's got a reputation for being pretty tight-lipped. I'm not sure a little act like the one you put on for Gillespie would work on a hard-boiled character like Monroe.
Act?
Conrad left Wallace standing outside the cell block as the deputy watched with a worried frown on his face. Conrad went straight to his hotel, where the desk clerk handed him a city directory. It took only a moment to look up the address of Carl Monroe's office. Wallace had said that the authorities would question Monroe, but Conrad wanted to get to him first. The clerk gave him directions to the address. The building was only about 4 blocks away. Monroe's office was on the second floor, above a bank. The building had one of those newfangled elevators, but Conrad took the stairs. Gilt letters on the pebbled glass upper half of a door in the hallway read, Carl Monroe, Attorney at Law. Conrad didn't knock. He grasped the knob with his left hand while his right hovered near the butt of his Colt. He didn't expect to walk into another ambush in the lawyer's office, but it didn't pay to take too many chances. He turned the knob and shoved the door open. An attractive woman with blonde hair swept into an elaborate pile of curls on top of her head looked up from a typewriter on her desk.
Yes, may I help you?
He glanced around the room. It was a typical outer office, with the desk, a coat rack and hat tree, and a couple of filing cabinets. A portrait of President McKinley hung on the wall, looking down in solemn dignity. For all that, the rug on the floor was a little threadbare, and the walls could have used a fresh coat of paint.
I need to see Mr. Monroe.
I'm not aware of any appointments he has at this time. Is this concern a legal matter?
You could say that. It involves a couple associates of his named Gillespie and Farley.
I'm not familiar with those names.
Even as she spoke, Conrad saw her shift slightly in her chair, and his keen ears picked up the faint sound of a buzzer from behind the door leading to Monroe's private office. He knew the woman had used her foot to press an alarm button. Monroe probably had another way out of his office. Conrad didn't wait. He moved past the blonde's desk in a hurry. She leaped up from her chair and tried to grab his coat.
You can't!
But she was too late. He was already ramming his shoulder against the door of Monroe's office. It slammed open, and he saw movement from the corner of his eye. A bulky figure was halfway through another door on his way out. Conrad drew his Colt and eased back the hammer. He figured the sound of the gun being cocked might be enough to stop the fleeing figure in his tracks. It worked. The man froze in the doorway.
Don't shoot!
Turn around. Slowly.
The man did as he was ordered. He was short, heavy-set, had a florid face, and hair that looked like it had been slicked down with black shoe polish. His suit, like his offices, appeared to be of good quality at first glance, but another look revealed its worn, shabby nature.
I don't know who you are, friend, but you don't have to bust in here with a gun. I'm always glad to talk to anyone, especially a potential client.
I'm not a client. I'm Conrad Browning.
The look of alarm that flashed in Monroe's eyes told Conrad the lawyer recognized his name.
If you'll put that gun away, Mr. Browning, I'll be happy to discuss whatever it is that's bothering you.
What's bothering me is that you paid Ed Gillespie and Walt Farley to kill me.
My God, I never did such a thing. I don't even know who you're talking about.
What I want to know now is who paid you to hire them. Tell me that and our business is done.
It's impossible. I can't tell you something I don't know anything about.
Mr. Monroe, do you want me to summon the authorities?
No. I'm sure that's not necessary.
Something in Monroe's expression warned Conrad. He turned around in time to see the blonde had picked up the freestanding hatchery and was swinging it at his head. He twisted quickly, and the base crashed against his shoulder instead of his skull. The impact was enough to make him stagger and drop his gun. The blonde drew the hatchery back and tried to ram it into his belly. Conrad caught hold of it and wrenched it from him. A glance over his shoulder told him Monroe was running again. Conrad turned to go after him, but the blonde leaped on his back. The unexpected weight sent him to his knees. She wrapped one arm around his neck and clawed at his face with the fingernails of her other hand. He jerked his head away from her and reached back to grab the pile of blonde curls. Leaning forward, he pulled, and the woman slid over his head and went crashing to the floor. The chivalrous part of him hated to treat a female that way, but he ignored it for the moment as he sprang to his feet. The struggle had delayed him long enough that Monroe had gotten away. The door into the corridor stood open. Conrad snatched up his Colt, then raced through the door and out into the hall. He made a dash for the same stairs that had taken him to the second floor and bounded down them to get to the lobby just as the door of the elevator cage opened a few yards away. The look of fright on the face of the elderly black elevator operator warned him. The man flinched aside as Carl Monroe thrust a small pistol at Conrad. Conrad threw himself forward and down. The bullet went over his head and hit the marble floor of the bank occupying the ground level of the building. Monroe bolted from the elevator and made a run for the front doors with surprising speed for a short, fat lawyer. He clutched the pistol in his hand, and with pandemonium breaking out in the bank because of the shot, it was an unlucky break for Monroe that he was armed. The guard at the doors drew his own weapon.
Here, hold it right there!
The lawyer didn't slow down. It was impossible to tell whether he brandished his gun at the guard on purpose or if the muzzle just swung in that direction because Monroe was pumping his arms as he ran. Either way, as the barrel of Monroe's gun rose toward the guard, he fired. Monroe pitched forward to land on his face and slide across the slick marble floor until he came to a stop almost at the stunned guard's feet. The guard slowly lowered his gun and stared at the dead lawyer with horrified eyes.
Holy cats, that's no bank robber. That's Mr. Monroe.
As Conrad came to his feet, he felt sorry for the guard. The man had heard the shot, seen somebody rushing toward him with a gun, and hadn't paid any attention to who it was. Thinking he was about to be gunned down by a fleeing robber, the guard had opened fire. Nobody could blame him. But they might blame Conrad for starting the ruckus. He long-legged it back to the nearby stairs and went up them in a hurry, heading toward the still-open rear door of Monroe's office. He could plainly hear the commotion downstairs and knew it wouldn't be long before the law showed up. He went into the office warily, just in case that homicidal blonde was still there and might try to brain him again. He didn't see any sign of her in either office. Clearly, she had realized a lot of trouble was about to come crashing down and had taken off for the tall and uncut while she had the chance. He was looking for a name he might recognize or any sort of communication with a San Francisco address on it. All across the country as he searched for his missing children, Conrad had run into traps set for him by Pamela years earlier. She had hired men to try to kill him, and he was convinced the latest attempt on his life was one more instance of that. Maybe Pamela had made the arrangements with Monroe directly when she passed through Carson City with the twins, but she might have used an intermediary in San Francisco to set it up. That was the name Conrad was looking for. Not finding anything among the papers on the desk, he jerked open the drawers and pawed through them. That proved just as fruitless, leaving only the filing cabinets in the outer office. He hurried in there and yanked open a drawer. He pulled out a handful of papers and started skimming through them, discarding them when he didn't find any helpful information. The sheets of correspondence, bills, and legal documents drifted down and soon covered the floor around his feet. He was working on the third drawer when he found a stack of memorandums dated almost 3 years earlier. One of them bore the scribbled notation, D.L. Golden Gate, $5,000 CB. Below that, written in a slightly different colored ink, probably at a different time, were the initials EG and WF, followed by $300. Ed Gillespie and Walt Farley, Conrad thought. Someone had paid Monroe $5,000 to set up the ambush, and he had turned around and paid Gillespie and Farley the princely sum of $300 to carry out the killing. You get what you pay for, Conrad told himself, and Monroe hadn't gotten much out of Gillespie and Farley except spectacular failure. Conrad had no doubt the CB on the note meant him. The Golden Gate was the opening between the Pacific Ocean and San Francisco Bay, and it was also a popular name for businesses in the city. But who or what was D.L.? Conrad had no idea. Claudius Turnbuckle might be able to find out. Conrad would wire him with the information immediately, so Turnbuckle could start working on the problem while Conrad was on his way to San Francisco. He stuffed the memorandum in his pocket and turned away from the filing cabinets. When he came around to face the door, he stopped short and didn't move except to raise his hand slightly. He was staring down the barrel of a gun.
Mr. Browning, you're making it mighty difficult for me to extend the courtesy to you that I want to. There's only so far your reputation as one of our former leading citizens will get you.
Take it easy, deputy.
Conrad didn't know if Wallace had seen him slip the piece of paper in his pocket, but he didn't intend to give it up unless he absolutely had to.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Carl Monroe's lying on the floor of that bank downstairs, dead as a mackerel.
I didn't shoot him. You can check my gun. It hasn't been fired since that ruckus in front of the hospital earlier.
Wallace came farther into the office.
I know who shot Monroe. There are plenty of witnesses to what happened. I'm not going to lose any sleep over him getting ventilated. He was always too slick to get any blood on his own fingers, but he was part of plenty of dirty dealings that wound up with people getting killed. That doesn't mean you're in the clear here. Monroe got shot because he was shooting at you.
That sounds to me like I didn't do anything wrong, like I was the victim.
Blast it, I knew you were going to come here. That's why I didn't tell you where Monroe's office was, and I tried to get the marshal's permission to pull Monroe in for questioning as quick as I could. But you beat me here anyway, and now he's dead.
There's nothing illegal about paying a visit to a lawyer in his office. Monroe panicked when I showed up and told him who I was. Seems to me that's just as good as a confession that he was mixed up in that attempt on my life.
What happened then?
Can I put my hands down?
Wallace thought about it for a second, then shrugged and motioned with the barrel of his gun for Conrad to lower his hands.
You said Monroe panicked. What do you mean?
He ran out of here before I could stop him. I went after him. He took the elevator, so I went down the stairs. We got to the lobby of the bank at the same time. He took a shot at me and tried to rush out. The bank guard thought Monroe was a robber and was trying to get away with the bank's money. He opened fire. That's all I know, deputy.
Yeah?
Wallace motioned with his gun at the litter of papers on the floor.
What about all this?
It was like this when I came back up here. Somebody must have come in here after Monroe and I ran out and started going through his papers.
Somebody, eh? Who would do a thing like that?
Maybe somebody who worked for Monroe, or some other business associate. You said yourself he was mixed up in plenty of crooked work. Someone could have been trying to find blackmail material or something like that.
I don't know who was the slickest one here, you or Monroe?
Wallace holstered his pistol and a cross-draw rig on his left hip.
I got a strong hunch you're not telling me the whole truth, Mr. Browning, but I don't reckon I can prove it. Since there are more than a dozen witnesses downstairs who can confirm that you didn't shoot Monroe, just get out of here. You're free to go.
I suppose you want me to stay in Carson City.
No, I'd rather you get out of town. The marshal may not agree with that, but considering the hell that's broken loose today, I think it would be in the interest of public safety for you to let us shuck out of here.
That can be arranged.
I warn you, though, Monroe had a secretary, a woman named Lorraine Eastman. I'm going to find her and talk to her. If she tells a different story than you do, I may be issuing a warrant for your arrest.
Wallace could issue all the warrants he wanted, Conrad thought. By the time the lawman got around to doing that, he would be in San Francisco and that warrant wouldn't mean a thing. If necessary, Conrad wouldn't come back to Carson City. After all, it was no longer his home. It was just one more in a long line of places where people kept trying to kill him. With everything that had been going on, Conrad hadn't had a chance to get to the train station and check to see when the next westbound train would be coming through. To his chagrin, he learned he had missed the train by an hour.
But there'll be another westbound at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, Mr. Browning. Would you like a ticket on it?
Yes, thanks. All the way through to San Francisco.
The delay chafed at him, but the quickest way to reach the coast was to wait for the train the next morning. He went back to the hotel to wash up, change clothes, and eat a late lunch. He had almost accomplished the first two of those goals. He was buttoning up a clean shirt when a knock sounded on the door of his suite. Considering what had already happened, Conrad figured it would be a good idea to be careful. His gun belt was draped over the back of a chair in the sitting room. He slid the Colt from its holster as he went to the door.
Yes?
Conrad stepped quickly to one side, in case somebody in the hall decided to let loose with a shotgun blast through the door. Instead, he heard a voice he recognized as belonging to one of the bellboys.
I have a telegram for you, Mr. Browning.
Conrad started to ask who the wire was from, then realized the message was probably sealed up and the boy wouldn't know. He tucked the gun behind his belt where it would be handy and opened the door. The bellboy's eyes widened a little at the sight of the black gun butt sticking up at Conrad's waist.
Here you go, sir.
He held out the Western Union envelope. Conrad took it, nodded his thanks, and handed the boy a silver dollar. He shut the door and tore open the envelope to slide out the yellow telegraph flimsy. A frown creased his forehead as he read the words printed on it in the telegrapher's block letters. Will knock on your door in 5 minutes. Stop. Please talk to me. Stop. There was no signature. Conrad studied the telegram for a long moment, then abruptly crumpled it and tossed it in a wastebasket. He hurried back to his bedroom, finished buttoning his shirt along the way, and picked up his clean suit coat to shrug into it. He had brushed his hat as clean as he could, so he settled it on his head, then picked up the gun belt on his way back through the sitting room. He pouched the iron and buckled the belt around his hips. His hand was on the butt of the Colt as he opened the door and stepped into the corridor, which was deserted at the moment. The hotel had elevators, several of them, in fact, but there was also a stairwell down the hall to the left, and the door to it was set back in a small alcove. Conrad went to it and stepped into that alcove, then stopped and edged his head slightly past the corner so he could look back down the corridor. He had a good view of the door to his suite. He wanted to see who was going to knock on that door in a couple of minutes. He still had a lot of acquaintances in Carson City. None of them had anything to do with him now, though. It wasn't like he had tried to keep in touch over the years. In fact, some of his former friends were probably still angry with him for making it look like he had died when his house burned down, then letting everyone believe that for months. The only other people he knew were Deputy Wallace and Dr. Liam Taggart, and neither of them would have sent him a telegram. If they'd wanted to talk to him, they simply would have shown up at the hotel and knocked on his door. There was something fishy about that telegram, and he wanted to know what it was. Staking out his suite door seemed like the best way to find out. He stiffened as a man emerged from the elevators and came along the corridor, looking at the numbers on the doors. He wore a gray suit and a black derby and sported a close-cropped beard. Conrad had never seen him before, at least not that he recalled. He put his hand on his gun butt again as the man paused in front of his door, then took a piece of paper out of his pocket and looked at it for a second. He put the paper back, shrugged to himself, and raised his hand to knock. Suddenly, the cold ring of a gun barrel pressed itself to the back of his neck.
I knew you'd take the bait.
Conrad moved with blinding speed, twisting away from the gun and whirling around. His left arm came up, hit the woman's arm, and knocked it to the side so the gun was no longer pointing at him. He drove his body against hers, forcing her back against the wall of the alcove, and closed his hand around the cylinder of the little revolver so it couldn't fire even if she pulled the trigger. He wrenched the gun out of her fingers. His other hand came up and caught hold of her chin.
I'm not the only one who took the bait, Miss Eastman.
Conrad kept the pressure on Lorraine Eastman's chin, preventing her from screaming or making even the smallest outcry. Her blue eyes were wide with fear as he pinned her to the wall. He was aware of the warm, full curves of her body under her dress, but at the moment they didn't mean much to him. After another minute, the man down the hall gave up and walked back to the elevator.
We're going to my suite. Don't make a racket and you won't get hurt.
Back in his room, Conrad turned Lorraine Eastman around, but kept his hand around her mouth.
I know I'm not being much of a gentleman, and I'm truly sorry about that. But you've attacked me a couple of times now, and I want to know why. If I take my hand away from your throat, do you promise not to scream?
She glared at him for a couple of seconds. Then a look of resignation came into her eyes, and she nodded. Conrad didn't believe her.
I can knock you unconscious before you manage to get a peep out, and I will if you don't cooperate. I'll try to pull my punch, but I can't promise you won't be injured. I have the rest of the day and all night if you want to be stubborn about this.
The fear in her gaze struck him as genuine.
Now, do you promise not to scream?
She nodded her head, and he believed her. He moved his hand away from her throat, but held it ready to strike if he needed to.
I'm not going to yell. If you'll swear to let me go, I promise to tell you whatever it is you want to know.
You answer my questions first, and then we'll talk about what's going to happen to you. That's the best deal you're going to get.
All right. I agree. Now, will you stop pawing me and let me sit down?
Keeping you from trying to kill me isn't exactly the same as pawing you.
Conrad released her and pointed to one of the well-upholstered armchairs.
Sit down.
The blonde sat. She wore the same dark blue dress she had worn at Monroe's office earlier. a matching hat perched on her head. She had tucked her hair back up as best she could after Conrad wrecked the arrangement of curls. She looked down at the floor.
What is it you want to know?
Your name is Lorraine Eastman, isn't it?
That's right. How did you know that? Never mind. I suppose the law told you. They've been trying to get something on Mr. Monroe for as long as I've worked for him.
How long is that?
I've been his secretary for the past year and a half.
What happened to the secretary he had before that?
He fired her when she... well, when she turned up in a delicate condition.
Pregnant?
If you want to be crude about it.
And I suppose Monroe was responsible for that.
Again, if you want to be crude about it... yes. I didn't really know what happened until later when the woman came back to the office to beg Mr. Monroe for money. He laughed at her and sent her away.
Nice fellow. I suppose you were so quick to defend him earlier because the two of you...
God, no! He was the most contemptible little weasel I ever met. But he paid well. And I didn't want anything to happen to him. That didn't work out too well, did it?
Is that the only reason you cared? Because of the money he paid you?
I didn't want any trouble with the law. When you said he tried to have you killed, I was afraid you were going to bring in the authorities and they'd finally have something on him they could use to convict him. I knew if that happened, they would arrest me too and claim that his secretary had to be aware of all his crooked dealings.
Well, aren't you?
Of course I was. I'm not a fool. I saw the sort of men who came and went in that office, and I typed up his correspondence and notes. I hadn't worked for him long before I knew what he was up to.
Why come after me? If you hated Monroe like you say, it couldn't have been to avenge him.
I don't care that he's dead. But now the law's after me, and I need money to get out of town. I did some asking around about you, Mr. Browning. You're a rich man, even if you did come into the office with mud all over your clothes. I figured you could pay me enough to get me out of Carson City so I could start over somewhere else.
You mean you intended to rob me at gunpoint? That's why you sent a telegram and paid some fellow you probably found in a saloon to come and knock on my door. You figured I'd be suspicious and try to spy on my visitor, and that alcove was the best place to do so. It was a cunning little trap.
But you figured out what was going on and turned the tables on me. I underestimated you, Mr. Browning.
So what do we do now? Do I turn you over to Deputy Wallace? I know he'd like to talk to you. He probably has a lot of questions about what went on in Monroe's office.
They'll lock me up. I couldn't stand that. I'll do anything you want, Mr. Browning, as long as you don't turn me over to the law.
That's not going to work.
Are you sure?
Positive. But I might be more inclined to let you go if you can tell me what this means.
Conrad reached inside his coat and brought out the piece of paper he had taken from the filing cabinet in Monroe's office. He held it out to Lorraine, who took it tentatively and studied the words printed on it.
Who or what is D.L.?
I have no idea. You can see from the date that Mr. Monroe wrote this note before I came to work for him.
That's Monroe's writing? You're sure about that?
Yes, I've seen it often enough.
She pointed to the memorandum.
This other part, with the initials and the $300, I can tell you that was written fairly recently. It's in a shade of ink that we never used until I bought some a couple months ago.
That was an interesting bit of information, Conrad thought. It indicated something or someone had triggered the deal Monroe had made 3 years earlier. Conrad figured that trigger had been him setting out from Boston to search for his missing children. He had suspected all along that Pamela had hired spies to keep an eye on him. The conspiracy against him stretched across the country like a giant spider.
Is there anything else you can tell me?
Well, the initials have to refer to Ed Gillespie and Walt Farley. Bet you know that already.
What about Golden Gate?
That's something to do with San Francisco, isn't it?
But you don't recall Monroe ever saying anything about it.
No, I'm afraid not. I've told you everything I know, Mr. Browning. I'm sorry about, well, about what happened outside.
About trying to rob me, you mean?
I was desperate. I still am. Since you were responsible for Mr. Monroe getting killed, I thought it was fitting that you helped me get away.
Monroe was responsible for his own death. If he'd been honest, it wouldn't have happened.
Honesty might postpone death sometimes. It doesn't prevent it.
Conrad opened the cylinder of the little pistol he had taken from her and shook out the bullets, then snapped the gun closed and tossed it in her lap.
You can get more bullets. I don't want you being tempted to point that thing at me again. I don't like it.
You're not going to turn me in?
He slid his wallet out of his coat pocket and removed a few bills. Lorraine's eyes widened at the sight of them.
Take the money and get out.
Conrad extended the bills to her.
I don't want to lay eyes on you again. A while back, I ran into another pretty young blonde who kept trying to murder me. She wound up dead.
That was true enough, although Conrad wasn't the one who killed her. He was going to let Lorraine Eastman draw her own conclusions, however.
If I see you again, I'm liable to get suspicious. I won't ask questions, and I won't wait to do something about it. I'll take action right then and there.
You don't have to worry, Mr. Browning.
The bills disappeared somewhere inside her dress.
I promise you, you're about the last person I want to see again. There's an eastbound train this evening. I intend to be on it.
I'd be careful if I was you. Deputy Wallace will probably have men watching the depot.
She got to her feet.
Those lawmen will never see me unless I want them to.
Conrad kept his hand on the butt of his gun as Lorraine went to the door. She paused and looked back at him.
What is it that's so important about you? Why would someone in San Francisco pay $5,000 to have you killed?
It's a long story.
I don't really care. I was just curious for a second. You better be careful. There are probably more people out there who want you dead.
I think you can count on that.
Considering the hour, Conrad ate an early supper instead of a late lunch. The rest of the evening and the night that followed passed quietly. He couldn't help wondering if Lorraine Eastman had managed to get on that eastbound train and leave Carson City, but he didn't care enough to find out. He and Arturo had been traveling light on their cross-country journey, but once he was in Carson City, Conrad had bought more clothes, as well as the new Colt. Even so, he had only a couple of small bags to take with him to the train station the next morning, and he carried them himself rather than having the hotel send them over. At one time in his life, he had been accustomed to having servants take care of his every need, but now he was more self-sufficient. He wasn't surprised when Deputy Wallace strolled up to him while he was standing on the platform, waiting for the westbound train.
Good morning, Mr. Browning. You didn't have any more trouble after the last time I saw you yesterday, I trust?
Not a bit.
No one tried to kill you? No shots were fired?
It appears Monroe and his hired guns were the only ones after me.
The only ones here in Carson City, anyway.
It's hard to predict what a person will run into elsewhere, isn't it?
Not always. For example, I predict when you arrive in San Francisco, you'll find yourself in more trouble. I did some checking, and that seems to happen all the time with you.
It's not my idea. I just want to be left alone to go about my business.
From what I could tell, you have teams of lawyers in Boston, Denver, and San Francisco take care of your business for you. Or were you referring to something else, Mr. Browning?
I'm leaving town, Deputy. Isn't that what you wanted?
Fine. I won't be sorry to see you go.
Say, did you ever find that woman who worked in Monroe's office?
No, but we will. She's still around somewhere. She couldn't have gotten out of town without us knowing about it.
Conrad would have been willing to bet the deputy was wrong about that. But he kept that thought to himself. Conrad arrived in San Francisco that evening. The train had passed over the Sierra Nevadas and through some spectacularly beautiful scenery since he boarded it that morning, but he hadn't paid any attention to any of it. He'd spent the time thinking about what he would find when he reached the city by the bay. Would he step off the train and ride into the gun sights of some other hired assassin who wanted to kill him? At first glance, the only person waiting for him on the platform was the tall, burly Claudius Turnbuckle. The ruggedly built lawyer with mutton-chop side whiskers was a distinctive figure, immediately recognizable. Turnbuckle moved forward as Conrad came down the portable steps from the railroad car. He extended a hand, which Conrad gripped firmly.
Welcome back to San Francisco. Any problems during the last leg of the journey?
Conrad shook his head.
No. Nothing happened on the train, except that I got pretty bored.
Yes, I can understand why you'd feel that way, what with no one shooting at you or anything. But, seriously, I'm glad you're here, Conrad. You're too much in the habit of going it alone.
I wasn't actually alone. Arturo's been with me.
Yes, and Arturo's a fine man, but you know what I mean. We have resources, Conrad. There's no point in not taking advantage of them.
Tell me what you found out.
Conrad had wired Turnbuckle from Carson City the previous evening, asking the lawyer to check up on the information from the note he had found in Monroe's office. Turnbuckle took Conrad's arm and steered him toward the depot lobby.
I have a carriage waiting out front, and I'll have someone bring your bags to the hotel. We can talk while we're riding.
As they moved through the station, Conrad noticed several well-dressed but nondescript men moving along with them. A second glance showed him how tough and capable they looked, and he realized they were bodyguards hired by Turnbuckle to make sure no ambush took place at the station. Conrad appreciated that, but at the same time, worried about how effective he would be in carrying out his investigation if he had guardians tagging along with him everywhere he went.
I booked a suite for you at the Palace Hotel.
Turnbuckle opened the door of a well-appointed carriage with gleaming brass trim and a team of fine black horses. Conrad climbed into the vehicle and took the rear seat. Turnbuckle followed and faced him, riding backward.
What about DL and the Golden Gate?
Do you have any idea how many Golden Gate this, that, and the others there are in this town? It's a popular name. But I have men combing through the city directory and pounding the pavement, trying to find some connection between a Golden Gate and something with the initials DL. It's going to take a few days to cover all the possibilities.
DL is probably a person.
Probably, but not necessarily. Again, there are too many people in San Francisco to put our finger on the correct one right away.
I'm not complaining, Claudius. You don't have to defend your efforts.
I just want to do the best we can for you. You've been through so much.
Everyone has misfortune in their lives.
Yes, but you've had more than your share.
So you don't really have anything to report?
Not yet, but we're just getting started.
I appreciate that. I really do.
What you should do is take a few days to rest. You have the finest, most comfortable suite in the hotel. You should relax and enjoy it. Regain some strength. You've run into trouble everywhere you've gone ever since you started searching for the children. You need to get away from all that for a while and let us worry about carrying on the search.
I suppose you're right.
Conrad leaned back against the sumptuous cushions. In truth, he had no intention of sitting back and doing nothing. Once, maybe, he could have done that, but no longer.
Whoa!
Suddenly, the carriage lurched to the side, then came to an abrupt stop.
What in blazes are you doing? Move that thing!
Turnbuckle leaned out the window.
What's wrong, Harry?
Oh, some dunderhead driving a beer wagon pulled out right in front of us. Nearly ran into him, I did. And now he's blocking the street.
Alarm bells began to ring inside Conrad's head. Wagons and carriages nearly ran together in the streets all the time, he supposed. That was one of the hazards of living in a big city. But his instincts told him there was something wrong.
Are those bodyguards you hired following us?
Yes, they're supposed to be back there.
Hey, what are you doing with that axe?
Suddenly, Conrad heard some horses arrive from behind the carriage.
Claudius, I think we'd better get out.
We'll be safer in here.
I don't think we're...
Conrad rammed a shoulder against the door. He jumped to the street in time to see a huge mountain of beer barrels begin to roll off the big wagon that had blocked the carriage's path. One slammed into the horses hitched to the carriage. The poor animals went down under the impact.
Claudius, come on!
Turnbuckle scrambled out of the carriage. The lawyer grabbed Conrad's arm to keep himself upright. They had to get out of the path of the barrels if they were going to survive. Buildings on both sides of the street were dark and shuttered for the night, and there were no alleys between them. There was nowhere for Conrad and Turnbuckle to go, and more barrels rolled off the wagon and came bounding toward them.
What are we going to do, Conrad?
We can't outrun those barrels. We need to dodge them. It's our only chance.
Conrad leaped high in the air to let one of them roll under him. Turnbuckle threw himself to the side to let another barrel fly past him. There were only 7 or 8 of the barrels left, but it would only take one to crush Conrad or Turnbuckle.
To your right, Claudius! Go to your right!
Turnbuckle flung himself in that direction, while Conrad leaped the other way. One of the barrels bounced off the cobblestones and flew between them.
Now toward me!
It was a deadly game, like children playing tag, but the stakes were much higher. Conrad and Turnbuckle darted here and there, ducked, leaped high, threw themselves aside. The frantic action lasted only moments, but it seemed much longer before the last of the barrels had caromed past them. The barrels weren't the only threat. Conrad reached for his gun. The Colt hadn't fallen out of its holster during all of his frenzied jumping around, and he brought the revolver up and sent two of the attackers spinning off their feet. The sharp smell of powder smoke mingled with the earthy, overpowering aroma of spilled beer. Conrad shifted his aim. Another gunman stumbled and dropped his weapon to clutch at his arm.
Let's get out of here!
The remaining bushwhackers broke off the attack and fled into the night. Conrad sent another shot after them to hurry them on their way, then went over to help a sprawled Claudius Turnbuckle to his feet.
Are you all right, Claudius?
Yes. I'm not hurt, just soaked in beer. Shaken up a bit.
Come on, I want to check on the driver.
It was too late to help the man. He was lying in the wreckage of the carriage, dead. The avalanche of beer barrels had killed all the horses as well. Conrad heard the San Francisco police on their way, drawn by all the commotion. Explaining this mess wasn't going to be easy. He could have been passed off as an accident, if not for the bodies of the slain gunmen. Luckily, he had Turnbuckle with him, Conrad thought, and it was the lawyer's job to explain things away. Before the police arrived, Conrad went to the abandoned wagon that had carried the beer barrels and blocked the street. There was nothing special about it. There were probably dozens just like it in San Francisco, maybe more. Something lying on the street next to the wagon caught his eye. It was round and shiny, and although he had no way of knowing for sure that it had fallen from the driver's pocket when he jumped down from the wagon's high seat, that was certainly possible. Conrad slipped the object into his pocket before the police could arrive. He would take a better look at it later. Uniformed men wearing peaked caps and carrying shotguns and pistols swarmed around him. Conrad let the police take his gun, then lifted his empty hands to show he wasn't a threat. Not far away, Claudius Turnbuckle was already blustering in his best lawyerly bluster. Conrad had a feeling it was going to be a good long while before he made it to the hotel for that rest and relaxation Turnbuckle had urged him to take.